The National Archives podcast series, Total War, presented by Professor Gary Sheffield.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, very pleased to be here, to be invited to speak on this programme. What I'm going to talk today is on this subject of total war. Now, total war is a very key aspect of historical debate among military historians at the moment. And one of the reasons for that is quite simply, there is very little agreement what this term actually means. Certainly, if you go back into the 1960s, the likes of the social historian Arthur Marwick would have said that total war is really all about war and social change. The idea that war acts as a spur to social and political development. Others might say that the essence of total war is about the mobilisation of a state for war fighting. Yet others would talk about simple ruthlessness in the conduct of war. Another way of looking at it is through the prism of the writings of the great 19th century Prussian military thinker Karl von Clausewitz. His idea of absolute war has been seen by some as being like total war is the nearest that you actually get to that in reality. And Clausewitz's thinking was influential among nuclear strategists who found these playing around with ideas of absolute and total war as being helpful tools for understanding how nuclear weapons might or indeed might not be used as a strategic weapon. Or is it simply rhetoric? In 1943, Josef Goebbels, the German propaganda minister, whipped up a crowd by demanding of them, "Do you want total war?" And also in 1943, Churchill came close to equating total war with simply modern war, the war that was being fought at the time. Or possibly my favourite quote, is it, to quote the Australian historian Trevor Wilson, simply a bloody big war? Now, what is clear is there is very little in the way of consensus about what total war means. However, I'm going to be using that working definition. A war conducted with the utmost ruthlessness, in which the entire resources of a state and a society, human, technological and economic, are directed to the achievement of victory. In short, it's an all-out war. It is certainly more than rhetoric, and it certainly encompasses ruthlessness, but it's the fact that you have massive resources being conducted to the end of achieving victory, which is the essence of total war. Now, if you ask a historian when the first total war was, depending on who it was, you might get many, many different answers. And of course, there are many examples in history of extreme ruthlessness in war. This is just one of them, in the 30 Years' War. The storming of Magdeburg, 1631, 25,000 people were killed. And bearing in mind, this is, of course, a pre-industrial army, it's a horribly impressive casualty figure. But does that mean that the 30 Years' War was a total war? Well, it might have been in terms of ruthlessness, but it doesn't really match up to the other criteria I mentioned just now. Total war is about more than just mass death and ruthlessness. And the criteria that I intend to use today to analyse total war are these. I'll run through them briefly and then we'll be using them to judge the various examples I'll be giving you in a little while. The first one are aims. How total or otherwise are the aims of belligerents? And particularly in a 20th century context, this has come to imply an ideological struggle, a death grapple between two competing ideologies, which rarely really doesn't leave much scope for a compromise peace. Lack of compromise, I guess, is the key here. But as we will see, that in total war, some aims are certainly more total than others. Secondly, commitment. This is, if you like, mobilisation. To what extent do states and societies mobilise, commit to war? And the level of mobilisation of a population, of its industry, its finance, is quite a good marker of the totality or otherwise of a conflict. Thirdly, weapons and targeting. This is, if you like, the ruthlessness argument. It implies the lifting of moral restraints on using particular weapons, and also against and a similar lifting of restraints on the targets they're used against. And one of the examples I'll be giving a little later on is the use of strategic bombing of enemy civilians by the air forces of the Western democracies in the Second World War. Fourthly, the geographical spread of a war. Now, I should straight away say that not all wars with a wide geographical spread are total wars. And conversely, it's entirely possible to have a total war that is fought within a relatively confined geographical area. But certainly looking at the two world wars in particular, there has been a tendency in a total war for it to involve ever larger parts of the globe, either actively, as in their bits that are fought over, or perhaps in a slightly less direct fashion by providing troops and raw materials. And again, I'll talk about that, particularly in the context of the Second World War, a little bit later. Fifthly and sixthly, and this is in many ways returning to the idea of total war as being an agent of social change, I would certainly argue that total wars do tend to have quite significant impacts on the societies that engage in them, and they also tend to have very significant political impacts. Again, I'll give you some examples of that a little later on. So these criteria, while by no means foolproof, and your perfect liberty to add to them or take away from them as you see fit, do I think provide a reasonable framework for analysing total war. Just briefly, I'd also should say that you can examine the limitation or otherwise of a war by using precisely the same criteria. Only this time we're talking about limitations on commitment, weapons choice, targeting, and all the rest of it. And limited war in general involves conscious and massive restraint, deliberately deciding not to spread the war, to attack civilians, whatever it might happen to be. And just to muddy the waters even further, it's perfectly possible to have asymmetric wars, in the sense that wars can be both total and limited at the same time, depending on whose perspective you are using. The Vietnam War, or the American part of the Vietnam War anyway, from 1965 to 73, is a good example of this. For North Vietnam, and arguably for much of South Vietnam, it was a total conflict involving the mass mobilisation of people's resources and all the rest of it. The United States, on the other hand, deliberately kept the war limited, did not mobilise on anything like the same scale as it did for the Second World War. The number of troops serving in Vietnam was always limited, and of course, critically, no use was made of nuclear weapons, which were certainly available. There was a deliberate decision not to do so. Okay. Just one more point about, general point about the totality of war before we move on to look at a series of case studies. And that is that total wars tend to be incremental in nature. They do not begin, or I'm hard pushed to think of any war which began as a total war in the sense I've just described it. Wars tend to become more total as they evolve. Now, in some cases, possibly we'd take the example of the Russo-German War, the war between the Nazis and the Soviets, 1941-45. It starts fairly total and becomes even more so. Other wars begin much more slowly and build up towards totality. Well, why is this? And I've put on the screen a number of points which I think are relevant to this. First one, what I've called the In Flanders Fields argument. This refers to the famous poem written by a Canadian medical officer in 1915, In Flanders Fields, which is often quoted, particularly in the media, around 11th of November, around Armistice Day or Remembrance Sunday, as being a reflection of all that's awful and wasteful about war. That's because they actually don't read the whole poem. Later on in the poem, McCrae, who is later killed in the war, actually, I can't remember the exact line, but I think it's effectively, he's talking about to pick up our quality for the flow. It's picking up the torch. In other words, what he's saying is that unless succeeding soldiers, recruits, battalions come out and carry on with the war, everything that's happened up to that point has been a waste of life. And this, in a sense, encapsulates the sort of horrible dynamic of total war. The more that war goes on, the more people are killed, the greater the sense of commitment to carry on, to make sure that those deaths were not for nothing. And this helps to explain why in a war like the First or the Second World War, it can be very difficult to come up with a compromise peace. Too much blood has been spilt, too much treasure has been spent, there has been too much emotional commitment to think of sitting down quietly around the negotiating table and say, okay, let's see how we can sort this out. Never underestimate the importance of the emotional aspect in warfare, particularly not in total war. The second point is rather more straightforward in a sense. Actually, it takes time to gear up peacetime industry to take up the slack of what is needed to equip armies, navies and air forces in a total war. It can't simply be done overnight. One very good example of this actually comes from the First World War, where the British Army had planned its shell expenditure, for example, in any future major war on the basis of shell expenditure in the Boer War, which had been a large-scale colonial war fought over 3 years. In fact, this proved to be a hopeless underestimation, and the British very rapidly ran out of shells to the extent that artillery batteries on the Western Front were actually limited. There were rations of the number of shells they could fire each day, which in turn created the so-called shells crisis, which brought about a political crisis, which actually brought about the downfall, helped to bring about the downfall of the last purely liberal government Britain's ever had. Fast forward 4 years. September 1918, the British Army on the offensive in what's become known as the 100 Days, the climactic campaign of the First World War. In the attack on the Hindenburg Line at the end of September, British artillery fired off just under 1 million shells in the space of 24 hours. And they were replaced within a matter of days. That is because British industry, and it must be said also industry of North America, were capable of producing vast numbers of munitions. That couldn't happen overnight. and looking at the totality of the commitment of Britain in terms of the development of its industries, an awful lot happened between August 1914 and September 1918. It's also, I think it's fair to say, that total war mentalities take time to grow, to develop. What happens in total war, and this I think is particularly true of democratic states, is it can take some time to shed inhibitions, to move away from taboos about what is and is not permissible in time of war. Again, to use a British example, the RAF was forbidden from bombing German civilian targets at the beginning of the Second World War for a whole range of reasons. Fear of retaliation against Britain is one of them, but there was also, I think, a deeply held reluctance to visit the horrors of war against civilian populations. By February 1942, all that had gone, and the RAF were authorised to begin what was euphemistically known as area bombing, popularly known as carpet bombing, which resulted in mass attacks on German cities, such as the massive firebomb attack on Hamburg in July 1943, and most famously, or I guess infamously, the attack on Dresden in February 1945. That quote from Alexis de Tocqueville, of course the French aristocrat who visited the youthful United States in the first half of the 19th century, I think is very appropriate. There are two things which a democratic people will always find very difficult: to begin a war and to end it. De Tocqueville, I think, put his finger on it exactly. Democracies are slow to reach, generally speaking, for the weapon of war, certainly not total war, but once their cage is rattled, democracies can be just as brutal, just as vicious, just as ruthless as any other state in pursuing victory. Okay, well, I'm mainly going to be talking about the 20th century, but it's worth pointing out that we can see some elements of totality in war, if not, I would say, full-blown total war, certainly back into the 19th century. And in many ways, the French Revolutionary Wars, Revolutionary Napoleonic Wars from 1792 to 1815, are key here. This has been described as a revolutionary era, not merely in the obvious sense, but also in the sense that a revolution in the conduct of war takes place. Well, if this is so, and I think it is, it's not a conduct that really has much to do with modern revolutions in military affairs, which tend to be focused around technology. The technology of the Napoleonic Wars was little different from that of 100 years before. Actually, it's a revolution about ideas. In particular, the idea that emerged in the French Revolution that soldiers, French soldiers, actually were citizens, no longer mere subjects of a king. And as such, they had a stake in the state, in the French state, and therefore they had a stake in the war that was threatening to overthrow the French state. And this revolution, which began in France, had an enormous impact, albeit in slightly different forms, even in the monarchical states of Europe that fought against them. It's tied up with the idea of nationalism. So, Spanish guerrillas fight against Napoleon from 1808 to 1814. Prussians fighting in 1813, 1814, they too bought into this idea that they had a stake in the state, and therefore this was a war which directly concerned them. Karl von Clausewitz referred in his great book on war to the remarkable trinity, the idea that you have the passions of the people alongside the government and the armed forces. And it's, if you like, it's this mental engagement with the populations which over time makes total war possible. Total war is not, or the examples I'll be looking at anyway, do not tend to be imposed from above. The people of the states engaging in total war buy into it. They internalise the struggle. It's about psychology as much as it's about weapons. And so in 1793, Lazare Carnot, the French Minister of War, declares the levée en masse and briefly has 1 million men under arms. Absolutely fantastic number of troops for that period, for a pre-industrial state to support. In fact, that million-man army doesn't last very long, but it's a distinct vision for the future. Napoleon had very wide-ranging aims, and to another aspect of total war, the geographical spread. Napoleon personally fought as far afield as Egypt and Moscow. And Napoleon sought, in effect, to bring all of Europe under his control. Pretty far-reaching, pretty total war aim. And in terms of sheer ruthlessness, well, I suspect it's probably the bloodiest battle of the period. Possibly the Battle of Leipzig in 1813 is even worse. But anyway, Battle of Borodino, fought outside Moscow in September 1812. 30,000 French, 45,000 Russian casualties. This is bloodletting on an enormous scale. Later in the 19th century, the American Civil War. One of the most astounding figure about this, I think, is the 622,000 soldiers from both sides that died in the American Civil War is more than the totals from American dead in the First and Second World Wars, Korea and Vietnam combined, out of a population which is tiny by today's standards, only 30 million. This speaks volumes about commitment of the troops on both sides and to some extent about the ability of the states of the Union and the Confederacy to mobilise those troops. And aside from battlefield victories, the North outproduced and overwhelmed the South. The North was a much more industrialised state than the South, but even so, the South, within very severe limits, was able to produce effectively an economic miracle in surviving and that long and equipping its forces to fight for that long. And this too was a war which, whatever it started off as being about, rapidly became one of ideologies in which the issue of slavery was at its core. The North, for example, mobilised large numbers of black troops to fight against the South. But in the end, so desperate were the Confederates to hang on to their independence that they actually emancipated the slaves, the very thing which, if you like, defined the Confederacy as being different from the North. And in terms of conduct, well, particularly the campaigns of 1864-65, William T. Sherman's campaign, going through Georgia and the Carolinas, deliberately destroying property, crops, both to cripple the Confederacy economically and also to undermine Confederate morale, proved to be highly effective. And Sherman's famous phrase there, "War is cruelty and you cannot refine it." His argument was simple. The harder you are, the more damage that you do, the sooner the war will be over. And the American historian Mark Grimsley has referred to this as being hard war. There's quite a debate about whether the American Civil War was total war, and Grimsley's term hard war, I think, sums up what was going on in the Civil War. The difference being sometimes Sherman's campaigns are compared to the strategic bombing campaigns of the Second World War. Key difference are, of course, that Sherman was destroying property and not life. Quite a lot of recent research into 20th century total war has laid emphasis on the colonial wars of the period as sowing the seeds for later total war. My own book on the on Douglas Haig, which was published quite recently, I mean, I came to that conclusion that a lot of the ruthlessness that he showed on the Western Front, you can see signs of this 15 years earlier in his conduct in the Boer War. And in the Second Boer War, 1899-1902, once the conventional battles were over, it was then a question of insurgency and counterinsurgency. And Lord Kitchener's strategy was effectively to starve the insurgents into surrender by denying them food, by burning farms, and herding the local population into concentration camps, which of course then did not have the meaning that it has now, and perfectly sums up what it was for, a camp in which you concentrate the population. There's a high death toll in the concentration camps, but it was largely through incompetence on the part of the British authorities, which led to sort of disease and so on and so forth, rather than deliberate cruelty. In sharp contrast, in another part of Africa, in Southwest Africa, in the revolt of the Hereros between 1904 and 1907, something like 65,000 Hereros, natives of the period, were killed. A clear example of early example of genocide by Germans, which actually recent work has suggested feeds through into the way that the Germans behaved in later wars, particularly the Second World War. Right, one more, a quick glance at the First World War, and then the rest of the lecture will be concerned with the Second, which is the best example of total war. In the First World War, we see aims were total, or at least they became so. The war increasingly became an ideological struggle as the Western powers, France and Britain in particular, played the democratic card, and Imperial Germany became more and more authoritarian as the war wore on. And aims certainly grew in the course of the conflict. There is a big argument about the extent to which Germany entered the war in order to achieve a mass empire in Europe. What is certain is that as early as September 1914, so a month after war broke out, a very wide-ranging programme of annexations of territory within Europe was being put forward. And the Germans, of course, in the course of 1917, knocked Russia out of the war and then spent a good deal of time organising defeated Russia into a large colony for the Germans. Minus the conscious genocidal approach of the Nazis, this in many ways prefigured what was to happen when the Germans launched another war against the Russians a generation later. And in the same way, I think we can see Allied war aims becoming more total as the war goes on. In terms of commitment, all states increasingly mobilised their forces, mobilised their resources even more so, and the German Hindenburg programme to try and mobilise the German economy and people for war, one of the best examples of this, though in the end it proved to be rather counterproductive by alienating large numbers of German people because of the way that the industrialisation policy was put forward. In terms of weapons and targeting, we can see restraints being lifted from very early on. Germans were the first to make use of poison gas at Ypres in April 1915. The Allies were very, very keen to follow. And we see war gradually escalating, sinking of passenger vessels such as Lusitania, and of course the bombing of civilian cities by both sides, by the Allies and by the Germans. And in terms of geography, social and political impact, again, you can find distinctly total aspects to this. But what I find interesting about the First World War is, although the war is in many ways a classic example of a total war, the conclusion of the war between Germany and the Allies is less total than one might think. Whereas in 1945, the Germans surrender unconditionally, basically when the whole of the country has been overrun, The German state, existing state, is destroyed and a new one is built up. The Germans effectively surrender, but they are not required, for example, for all of its army to go into prisoner of war camps. The German government changes at the very end of the war, but the Allies do not insist on occupying the whole of Germany, only a relatively small part, and they do not insist on remaking the German constitution and the German state in the image of the victorious powers. So the First World War is a very total war in many ways, except at the very last, when it reverts much more to a traditional pattern of ending wars. Okay, the Second World War, and I'm going to spend the rest of the talk looking at this. Looking at the aims of powers in the Second World War, I would just take two, Germany and Britain. And the point I want to make here is that both Germany and Britain undoubtedly fought a total war. Both had total war mentalities, but they were still rather different. Germany's war aims, there's a very big literature on this, but I will simplify for our purposes, is essentially about expansionism. Lebensraum, the search for so-called living room, which led them to fight Poland. And then although, of course, you had the campaigns against France, the Low Countries, and in Britain in the spring of 1940, these were essentially diversions from Hitler's real plan, which actually was to achieve expansion in the East. This was tied into a racist ideology by which the Slavs, and of course the Jews, and various other people were seen as being subhuman. Hence, I think we had rather different aims the Germans were pursuing in the East and in the West. In the West, certainly in the 1940 campaign, this is much more like an old-style traditional war. The war ends, the French are defeated, but even then the French, to some extent, get off, it's a rather different conclusion to the war in the East. France is divided into two. One part of it is at least nominally self-governing. And the French, though they certainly have a hard time, they do not have anything like the same degree of suffering and privation as in the East. In the East, it's about race, it's about ideology, it's about carving out a colony which will then be populated by Germans. The existing peoples, those who survive, will effectively be used as economic slaves. And the whole idea of Blitzkrieg, which is itself a very controversial subject, which I won't get into at the moment, it has been argued that what the Germans were trying to do was to fight a series of limited wars which, in other words, would be over quite quickly, but they were doing so to achieve total aims. So the war aims of Germany are deeply bedded in Nazi ideology, racism and expansionism. The British also, I think, had remarkably total war aims, or at least they became total. But they are different. And in Britain's case, you can see this idea of incrementalism at work. When Britain goes to war in 1939, it's specifically over the issue of the German attack on Poland. More generally, it's a belief that Hitler can no longer be trusted and he has to be stopped somewhere, and here is the point at which we fight. However, the government of Neville Chamberlain never, I think, lost hope that the war could end with a compromise peace. And certainly there was turns out to be rather naive belief that the German war economy simply would be unable to sustain the pressure of mobilising and fighting a major war, and somehow the German war effort might implode and collapse in on itself. The idea of a compromise peace is never very far away, in other words, with hopefully a post-Nazi government. That changes, British war aims changes to a simple one of survival in 1940. After the defeat of the French and the British, the evacuation from Dunkirk, Churchill coming to power as Prime Minister in May 1940, simply clinging on, survival is the primary British war aim. But by 1943, with the United States and the Soviet Union in the war as allies. And clearly, the initiative passing to the Allies, that war aim comes for the British, slightly reluctantly, because I think they were bounced into it by the Americans. Unconditional surrender, the idea that the Germans should give up and allow the Allies in to, in effect, do whatever they like with them, with their state, with their political system. A very, very far-reaching, very, very total war aim indeed. And yet, when we come to 1945, it's interesting to see what actually happens. One of the principal powers that the unconditional surrender demand was aimed at, Italy, did not surrender unconditionally. It was allowed to change sides, which it did later in 1943. And while Germany certainly surrendered unconditionally, and Britain played a sizable role in that outcome, Poland, the reason that Britain had gone to war in the first place in 1939, was in effect quietly forgotten, and Poland passed from domination by one hereditary enemy, Germany, to domination by another one, the Soviet Union. Britain's war aims, in other words, had evolved and moved on. And Poland, the reason for war in 1939, simply became overtaken by bigger events. A lot of people, quite rightly, had a bad conscience about it, but in the end, effectively, there was nothing the British could do, given that the Red Army occupied Eastern Europe. So, two total sets of war aims, but total in rather different ways. Ideology. The obvious clash is between German Nazism and Soviet Marxist-Leninism, Soviet Communism. And that, plus the fact that the Eastern Front was effectively a race war, gave the fighting in the East a distinct edge that was mostly lacking in the fighting in the West. Mostly, I should say, there are certainly exceptions to that. And in the scheme of things, I think that the Second World War can be seen as a vast ideological struggle between German Nazism on one side and a very uneasy short-term and purely tactical alliance between liberal democratic United States and Britain on one side and Soviet communism on the other. In fact, you could even break it down further than that and say there's also an uneasy alliance between old-fashioned imperialist Britain and capitalist United States. But the Second World War, more obviously than the First World War, was a war about ideology. At its simplest, what sort of world is the world going to look like once the war is over? And suffice it to say, had the Nazis triumphed, the world would have looked very different. Let's go back to something that Ben was saying before I started. We should not imagine that race wars were confined to the Eastern Front. To a large degree, the struggle between Japan and the United States, and for that matter, the British Empire and Japan, were tinged by elements of racism, of a race war. And I think there's this classic idea of fighting between in-groups and out-groups, in other words, between very diverse people, again, has a particular edge of brutality. But just to confuse matters even further, don't forget that the so-called British Army, which fought and won a very, very considerable victory in Burma in the Second World War, was overwhelmingly non-British in composition. It was composed of people from India, from different parts of Africa, Gurkhas from Nepal. I think I'm right in saying that by the end of the war, only 13% of the troops in Slim's 14th Army were actually British. So, race war is certainly there, but it's perhaps slightly more complicated than it appears at first sight. Right, in terms of commitment, people like league tables, don't they? If you actually draw up a league table of the degree of commitment of the various states, in terms of mobilisation of resources, it's actually quite surprising in many ways. Probably the least surprising bit is you get the Soviet Union at the top. After all, you do have an extremely authoritarian, autocratic state which has a remarkable degree of control over its citizens, and of course a ruthless and proven system of terror and intimidation to make people do what you want them to do. And of course you have all sorts of ruthless decisions being made in the siege of Leningrad, for example, which drastically cut rations for useless mouths, for those people who could not be productive either in fighting or producing weaponry. Perhaps more surprising is Britain comes in at number two, because after all, Britain was not that sort of society, is not that sort of society. And yet between 1939 and 1945, the British state mobilised more thoroughly for war, I think, than any other state with the exception of the Soviet Union. There are endless examples I could give of this, but just to pick a couple more or less at random, one of which is the fact that from 1943 onwards, because the British lacked sufficient people to dig up coal mines, young men were conscripted to go down the mines instead of going into the army. I think a few of you here might actually catch the cultural reference here. Two of the subsequently most famous ones were Jimmy Savile and Eric Morecambe. That's something I would say to my undergraduates. They look at me with a blank stare. Who are these people? Another example is the fact that in order to save fuel, people were rationed to having 5 inches of water in the bath. Now, what I find remarkable is not that the government passed a law saying you only don't have 5 inches of water in the bath, is that people actually obeyed it. There's no way that people could police this. People breaking, I suppose, to bathrooms and checking how much water you had in the bath. People actually, on the whole, stuck to this. That is a sense of the commitment of the British people to fighting this war. Also surprising is the fact the United States only comes in third. Why? Well, simply, the United States was so much richer than any other state and had a good deal of industrial slack to pick up because of the Depression era. It simply didn't need to carry out the same kind of wholesale mobilisation for war that other states did. So this is, in many ways, it's actually a misleading table, because if you actually look at the terms of production, the United States is at the top. It not only supplies its own armed forces, but those of many others, including Britain, and a large chunk of the Red Army as well. But it's the fact that America did not need to mobilise so thoroughly. But its production of war material was hugely impressive. Germany, I guess, also is a surprise to some people, because many have this idea of the Germans as being a very well organised and hugely efficient system. Anybody who's looked at the Nazi system will know that that was not the case at all. The German system was hugely inefficient, and that accounts for its lowly position in the league table. And much the same point can also be made about the Japanese. Targeting and choice of weapons. A quote from the American historian Victor Davis Hanson: "The Western way of war is so lethal precisely because it is so amoral, shackled rarely by concerns of ritual, tradition, religion, or ethics, by anything other than military necessity." Now, the context of this is his thesis about the superiority of the Western way of war, which is actually quite controversial, and I won't go into now. But I think he's certainly right when talking about the basically amorality leading to lethality of the Western way of fighting. And in the Second World War, we see some very good examples of that. Most obvious one, of course, is genocide. Most famously, infamously, I guess, practiced by the Nazis against their victims, particularly the Jews. But also, on the Eastern Front, there was a large-scale and often routine murder of civilians by Axis troops and indeed by Red Army troops as they were coming through Europe, through Eastern Europe, on the way to victory in 1945. But this is all of a piece, I think, with the decision by the Anglo-Americans to undertake strategic bombing. Now, I will set to one side the arguments about how effective strategic bombing was in crippling German war industry and so on and so forth. Because what I want to zoom in now is actually the decisions that were taken by democratically elected governments and largely supported by those electorates to deliberately target civilians, which is effectively what happens from 1942 onwards. Now, there are some people at the time, people like, for example, George Bell, the Bishop of Chichester, who stands up and says that this is morally wrong. It brings down the Allies to the moral level of the Nazis. But on the whole, there are few dissenters while the war is going on. After war is a different matter. And in a sense, the logical conclusion to this decision to wage war against civilians are the decisions to drop the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in August 1945. Again, there's a big debate on why these bombs were dropped. Was it, as some argue, not the last shot of the First World War, the last shot of the Second World War, but rather the first shot of the Cold War? Again, I think what interests us from this point of view is the idea that actually that there was very, I think there's little chance that President Harry Truman was ever not going to allow the bomb to be dropped. The war mentalities of this time, I think, were such that the use of a bomb, which, who knows, may shorten the war, very little thought was given other than to dropping it. Compare that with moral attitudes about the use of armed force against civilians before the war and indeed after it finished. In terms of geographic spread, the Second World War was enormous. For the Americans, of course, it was the two hemisphere war, simultaneously fighting major wars in the European theatre of operations and in the Pacific. And one of the major advantages that the British had in the war was being able to draw upon a very large colonial empire, which not only provided sizable numbers of troops, but also an enormous depth of economic resources that could be drawn upon. Indeed, some historians have gone as far as to say that the use that is made of the empire during the Second World War justifies the acquisition of these empires in the first place. Huge number of moral issues flying around there, but it's absolutely true that the empires proved to be of largely British, also to some extent the French, proved to be of critical importance to the Allies in the Second World War. And I put also on the slide South America, which for the most part was neutral for most of the war, though many South American states joined the Allies later on. The Brazilians actually sent troops to fight in Italy, surprisingly enough. But South America, although not formally part of colonial empires, proved to be a vital economic resource for the Allies. Something the Germans simply lacked. They tried to gain through their conquests in the East, Russia, but in the end, the oceanic-based empires proved to have the advantage over the land-based German empire. The social impact was enormous, and among the very many examples I could choose, remaking of societies, the obvious one is at the end of the war, Germany was divided into two. And the states and their societies reflected the character of the people, the states that actually occupied them. West Germany grew up to be a liberal democratic capitalist state created in the image of the United States and Britain. East Germany, of course, became a Marxist-Leninist state, created in the image of the Soviet Union. A rather different remaking of society, but nonetheless of great importance, is what happens in Britain. There is a substantial swing to the left politically in Britain during the Second World War, which results in the election of a majority Labour government in 1945, the first one in history, something which has been pretty well unthinkable had an election occurred in 1940 in peacetime conditions. And that in turn led to the greatest remodelling of British society of the 20th century, the creation of the welfare state, the idea of a mixed economy, and moving Britain distinctly down the road, a very British road to socialism. Not all of that, of course, has survived. Successive governments, particularly that of Margaret Thatcher from 1979 onwards, rolled back some of the what's been described as the Attlee settlement. But even today, this country is very visibly marked by the consequences of the Second World War, producing a rather different society than the one that was there in 1939. Without the Second World War, that almost certainly would not have happened. And in terms of political impact, three brief, very different but very important examples. The Second World War didn't so much bring about the end of the European empires, but speed the process up. Certainly the skids were under European empires, I think, before the Second World War, not least as a result of the First World War. But given the strength and importance of the empire in 1940, it's remarkable that by 1970, 30 years later, the British Empire, the French Empire, in fact European empires in general, had almost wholly disappeared, leaving only a few anomalies left, small colonies dotted around the globe. Without the war, stimulating nationalist movements, and particularly without the impact of the Japanese defeat of the colonial powers in 1941-42, which destroyed the air of invincibility which many of them had, again, I don't think this process would have happened nearly as quickly as it did. The second one was, of course, the Soviet domination of Eastern and Central Europe. A historian in 100 years hence might well look at the Second World War as simply being one small, albeit important, section of a European war which began in 1914 and went through to the end of the Cold War in 1989-1991. These ideas have already been put forward, the so-called short 20th century thesis by historians like Eric Hobsbawm. And in this, perhaps we see the Second World War as not ending for the people in Eastern Central Europe in 1945, but rather simply morphing into a different form of conflict, different form of occupation. Churchill in particular had a bad conscience about this, seeing as Prime Minister in 1944-45, he certainly saw, or at least had some idea, of what was going to be happening next in these parts of the world, but he was impotent to do anything about it. And finally, America's rise to globalism. Again, this is not the beginning of the process. The United States had stepped out of the world stage in the First World War, only to retreat into isolationism once the war was over. And indeed, there were some fears in Europe, certainly in Britain during the Second World War, that they would do exactly the same thing again once this war was over. But in the end, America, having become a global power and a major military power, did not retreat into isolationism after 1945. Indeed, history moved on into the period of, first of all, superpower competition, the Cold War, and into a period which many historians today would see as one of American hegemony. Again, it's difficult to see that would have happened without the impetus of the Second World War, a war which its impact was certainly total. Okay, just to sum up the very few points. Some have argued that the introduction of nuclear weapons in 1945 have brought about an end to total war, at least in the form as we saw it in the 20th century, because war has quite simply become too dangerous to pursue at that level of totality. The use of nuclear weapons would, of course, make war total from the word go, rather than actually have an incremental build-up. And one of the impacts of the introduction of nuclear weapons was to, if you like, cut off total war at its prime. After 1945, wars that were fought, certainly the wars that were fought involving nuclear armed powers, tended towards limitation rather than totality. The second is that some historians have put forward the ideas that total war has morphed, particularly in third world conflicts like Rwanda in 1994, into low-tech wars in which there is mass killing, but it tends to be using pretty rudimentary weapons, or something like the Kalashnikov, the AK-47, which has been described as the true weapon of mass destruction in terms of the number of people it's actually killed. I don't really buy this argument, because this is actually talking about totality purely in terms of ruthlessness and the large numbers of people being butchered. I actually think, as you've probably hopefully gathered, that totality in war is about something rather more encompassing. And my conclusion is simply that because, if you like, the bookending of the period by the invention of nuclear weapons, that total war is a Western phenomenon which has its roots in the French Revolutionary Wars, but flourishes, if I can put it that way, between 1914 and 1945, and it's largely a Western phenomenon.
This event was recorded live on the 23rd of March 2012 at the National Archives, Kew. This podcast is copyrighted to the National Archives, all rights reserved.